Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And my guest today has a new book out that deals with America's ongoing struggle with opiates and drug abuse, but also has some tales of leaving you with hope here that things are perhaps moving slowly in the other direction. He's Sam Quinones. He wrote the book Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, back in 2015, and I had him as a guest then. I had him as a guest about a year later to kind of update things, and now he's come out with this new book. It's called The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. And it's a disturbing book. I'll warn listeners, but it's very worth reading because I think Sam's done an excellent job of finding some tales of hope, as the subtitle says, to offer some measure of optimism for the future. Sam, thanks for coming on.
It's my pleasure, Robin. Thanks for having me again.
Well, it's tough to read, and there's a lot to unpack here, but I guess after Dreamland, and I know you traveled around the country talking about that and was in our area as well. You were in our area as well, but what kind of, is this just kind of an update since Dreamland of trends that have happened and offering some examples of the way communities are fighting back?
I guess you could call it that. I mean, I think it was kind of a separate book too, though, because it's about certain things that are happening, particularly in the drug trafficking world, that are very stark and different than what was going on before, and actually unprecedented in the history of the country, primarily the shift in Mexico by traffickers down there away from plant-based drugs and towards synthetic drugs, primarily fentanyl and methamphetamine, as I say on the subtitle of The Least of Us. That is an unprecedented thing. And what's more is that they have the ability to cover virtually the entire United States in the drugs, those two drugs. That's something that's never been achieved before, I don't think. And they've done that because synthetic drugs are easier and cheaper to make, and you can make them year-round because you no longer need land or sunlight or rainfall or seasons or any of that stuff when you're trying to grow drugs. Now all you need is a shipping port, and they've got two on the western coast of Mexico, Pacific coast of Mexico, you know, through which really they control, and the scads of just scandalous quantities of precursor chemicals are coming in from all over the world, but mainly, I think, China. But it doesn't really matter where they're coming from, actually, because you can get them almost anywhere if you have the proper ports, and they do. And so that has allowed them to create quantities of these two drugs that are, as I say, have covered the entire country, and turn those drugs into the most deadly, and in the case of methamphetamine, the most mind-mangling of drugs we've ever seen on our streets, cheaper, too.
And they're much more lethal.
I would say, yeah, well, in the case of fentanyl, there's no doubt. Fentanyl, by the way, fentanyl, as you said, fentanyl is a fantastic drug. It is a magnificent drug. I've had fentanyl myself. And when used in the medical context and medically and after surgery and so on, it is a revolutionary drug and has done a lot to make lives better in this country. But it's extraordinary. It's an opioid, just like heroin, just like oxycodone, all the others, codeine and morphine. But it's extraordinarily more potent. And that is what makes it very, very damaging in the hands of the wrong people, which would be the Mexican trafficking underworld. It doesn't change the fact that fentanyl has radically changed surgery and revolutionized medicine, but it is a very dangerous thing to have in the wrong hands.
You mentioned that you have a quote in here that I want to share with our listeners to have you talk about a little more. But you mentioned it a couple times in the book. I thought it was interesting. Drug traffickers behave like corporations, and corporations behave like drug traffickers. It's an intriguing line. Can you kind of define that a little more?
Yes. Basically, it has to do with my approach during this book was not to just focus on the drug underworld, but to instead focus on the neuroscience of addiction and also the legal products that are available and bombarding us, frankly. That would be, sugar, fast food, social media. Of course, we've gone on a long time about that. Gambling, pornography, video games, nicotine, alcohol, et cetera, et cetera. There's all this array of very, very potent, addictive substances and services that are constantly being marketed to us. And we have folks who are, in these corporate companies, hard at work trying to make them more addictive to us and more hit our brains harder and more quickly and with greater impulse to buy those products. To me, that was simply the beginning of a continuum that if you followed it out long enough and far enough, you get to the Sinaloa drug cartel in Mexico. It's the same idea. They just happen to be selling one product as illegal. The other, is legal. And I saw a great deal of parallels between the way these drugs are marketed. There's an idea in psychology that the way you make people stop a bad habit is by making that habit more difficult to do. And so that's what we've seen with cigarettes, for example. You know, you have friction. You can't find them everywhere. You can't smoke in bars or at beaches or parks and on and on and on like that. And that makes it more difficult to do, and so you have fewer people smoking. You don't end the bad habit by giving people always more information. We know that cigarettes are nicotine and tobacco is a killer since the 60s, and it hasn't stopped people from smoking. What does stop people from smoking is making it more difficult, and that's why companies that produce these products know that, and they know to make their products very easily accessible. So every freeway off ramp, every major intersection, you're seeing, ads for Burger King and McDonald's and all the rest. Social media, you don't finish a show on Netflix without it immediately transitioning into the next one. That's to keep you always watching, to make it easy to keep watching. Well, if you think about it, that's kind of what the drug trafficking world has done with fentanyl and methamphetamine in some regard. They cover the country, making it easier for us to use those drugs, very much reducing the friction, very much like Coke or Pepsi or McDonald's or any other company in this world that you want to mention has done. And so that's kind of what it dawned on me as I was writing this, that actually they're behaving like each other. You know, the corporations, consumer product corporations, very often behave somewhat like drug traffickers. And drug traffickers very clearly are trying to break it through so that their products are easier to come upon and therefore easier to use.
You know, your journey throughout the book, and I like the way you divided it up in the chapters and followed certain storylines through several chapters. But it just seems so familiar to me on this show that where I've been focusing on these types of issues back since the show originated in 2014. But it takes us through Muncie, Indiana, Hardin County, Ohio, Clarksburg, West Virginia, and then Dreamland. You go back and look at Portsmouth, Ohio, where Dreamland kind of centered on in your previous book. But it just seems like it's an ongoing story I see constantly of the role of the decline in manufacturing jobs on working class people, and it leads to loss of those jobs and then eventually substance abuse. And then you get to the case in Deaton book of the deaths of despair. I just seem to see this over and over, and it's not just our region here in the Midwest, but more across the country. But is that like one of the defining features of this is kind of going back to that manufacturing, the industrial factory town?
I would say that's certainly a big part of it. I would say along with that, in a lot of these industrial towns, there was an attitude, I think, that grew from the fact that these jobs were good jobs, stable and dependable jobs, and allowed you to buy a house and a vacation and send a kid to college, that there was an attitude among a lot of folks that education didn't matter. And that's what I'm kind of finding, too, in a lot of the towns, where this attitude, a lot of the folks who were mightily affected left those towns and they've gone on to other places. It seems to me that there is still in a lot of towns this attitude that we don't need education so much. Whereas it seems to me that this ought to be the most important thing you can possibly focus on is getting yourself a world-class education. So you've got all of these things arrayed. And I think the larger perspective, though, is that as a country, too, we have shredded community in the ways that you mentioned. But we've shredded the community in many other ways, it seems to me. Very well-to-do suburbs have these enormous houses where no sidewalks, nobody's walking, these houses are way too big for the families that live there. There's this feeling like we're all alone, and that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. I hate being around other people or other people I don't politically agree with them, so I don't be around them. There's this deep association this deep isolation that I think is really the common denominator, more so than economic devastation, because you are seeing this opioid epidemic spread throughout to Orange County, California, to Fort Lauderdale, to the suburbs of Indianapolis, which are very well-to-do. I think that the economic devastation, deindustrialization was a big part of that, but not the common denominator that really held this thing together. And to me, what was really part of this was that we just got used to the idea that we didn't need other people, even though the human species, really we exist on this planet today because we have bound together in community. It's what kept us alive. It allowed our survival and our prosperity, really. But we got away from that in this country, I would say, in the last 40 years, where we come to believe that we can go it alone. These other people really want to be around them. And, of course, the technology is further. As much as it's supposedly connected us, it's really isolated us even further.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is author and journalist Sam Quinones, whose new book is called The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. And the key word in that subtitle is hope. And that's what I want to focus on here for the rest of our discussion. You talk about the journey from judgment to empathy, which is tough. It takes a while to get to that because a lot of us want to just judge. That's our first reaction to this. But it really, I want to go through some examples of this, but I found it fascinating that one of the groups that was most willing to be look at this differently was law enforcement in some cases, you found.
Yeah, I found that to be true, that they're the ones who see it most clearly, most daily, along with paramedics and others, of course, and that very often, not always, of course, there's a lot of cases, but very often you find that it's law enforcement that's coming to rethink how we do this. And I would say there's kind of two stories like that in the book, because again, part of the book is about fentanyl and methamphetamine and the story we've already talked about, but fully half of the book is really about these stories about where people are changing their minds, which is such a radical idea if you think about it in our society. Where on Fox News and CNN has anybody ever changed his or her mind? It doesn't happen. And yet it is an essential part of it. And so in one case, for example, the sheriff of Hardin County, Ohio, Keith Everhart, guy, flat top, jaw chewing, Fox watching guy, comes to understand as he's elected sheriff that things are not really working well and he needs to change. And he starts to promote the idea that we need to find work for recovering addicts, people who are struggling with sobriety and getting out of dope. And then he realizes that he needs to do that himself. And he gives a job to one of the most notorious addicts, been in and out of jail many a time, in his own jail, in the county, a guy named Robert. And Rob starts as a janitor, fuzzy-minded because of the dope and so on. He's really struggling with it to move forward in his life. And eventually he's doing fairly well, and the sheriff makes him a dispatcher. You know, it's like these kinds of stories is what are the kinds of things that I wanted to do. Small stories, unnoticed stories of just people quietly with daily work looking to make their communities a little bit better, not worrying if it's not kind of nobly, virtuously saving the world, rather that it is just the smallest stuff. To me, that's really, and understanding that we are only as strong as the most vulnerable, as the least of us. I took the title, of course, from the Bible, from Matthew, where Jesus tells his followers, you know, that what you do for the least of my brethren, you do for me. Jesus understood the power, not the nice, the luxurious power of community, the essential nature of community. It's not a nice thing to have. It's essential to us. And I think he understood that, and he understood that the way you do that is you make sure that the folks who are at the bottom who are struggling most have a hand up, have a hug, have an arm around the shoulder saying, let's do this together. And I really do believe that that's where we got away from. So the stories in the book are really my attempts to find these unnoticed, unsexy, totally, you know, just routines kinds of stories that nevertheless have this power to them. And it was those stories that really enthralled me. I told the stories of the dope and the Mexican trafficking world and all that. I had to, and I understood that's not a problem. But I just felt like the real stories that inspired me, the heart and soul, half the book basically, is about these other stories.
Yeah, and some of them took place, you know, we the partisan divide is in our faces every day, and a lot of these took places somewhat surprisingly in what you describe as red areas, Republican, conservative areas.
Sure, and I think that's one of the stories I love to tell was about the jail in Kenton County, Kentucky, across the Ohio River from Cincinnati, and the idea was that they understand these. Again, these were people changing their minds, and I find that to be, again, I think it's a radical idea of today's America. Really, you don't see it too much. And the jailer there, and some of the county officials, all of them were Republican, had this idea. You know, it's not working. We got these people coming in and out of the jail, small time misdemeanor, low level felony charges. They really don't go to prison very much at all because the crimes that they're associated with are not major serious felonies, rape and murder and what have you. And so they decide we need to find a way of changing. And so what they do is they begin to experiment with ways of changing the jail into a place not where you just sit and vegetate, which is basically how jail in America has been done for, geez, years, decades, of course, but rather changing jail into a place of recovery. So you have a pod where people opt in, and then they join up for a real regimen of change. So they're making their bed every morning. They're in classes. They're not sitting around playing poker and watching Judge Judy. They are taking classes in criminal addictive thinking, GED classes. There's 12-step meetings run. And they find, miraculously enough, that actually this is a better way to run a pod. It's cheaper, and not nearly enough as many fights, fewer lawsuits. It's cleaner because the inmates themselves do the cleaning. And it's using jail for a way of moving forward in people's lives instead of a way of just keeping people where they are, which is, frankly, the way jail has always been done. And it is a disaster the way jail has been done all across this country for years. It seems to me like the opioid epidemic is actually calling on us to really reexamine some institutions, and jail is certainly one of them.
Well, before anybody out there starts thinking, this book and Quiñones is just coming at this from a left-wing progressive perspective, hold on, because one of the best things about this book that I commend you for is taking an objective look at both sides. And you call into question some things that the left has held in honor, too. One of them I thought that was interesting, you're a little skeptical towards decriminalizing marijuana and drugs generally, legalization. And also, I thought it was interesting when you talked about the use of jail, that some say we just need to get away from that. You kind of thought there was value to some degree in that.
No, I think particularly now with the drugs on the street being fentanyl and meth, you know, it is in no sense compassion to leave people on the street, right? I mean, that's a death sentence. Rock bottom is death. There's this idea that for drug treatment, we need to be ready. And that's true. Eventually, you need to come to embrace your own sobriety and be accountable for it and act in that way. However, on the street, it doesn't happen, particularly with the power and the prevalence in of the drugs on the street today. That just doesn't, it's not realistic. It does happen on occasion, but it's just not realistic. A far better idea, it seems to me, is to use those arrests for small-time stuff as a way of getting people, first of all, off the street, away from the dope. Really, there's no other treatment for methamphetamine addiction than just simply being away from the drug. You just can't be around. They have to be away from it and not use it. And getting people off the street means that you can begin, if you have jail properly oriented, you can begin that recovery there. And then after a person gets out, then there's other issues that other ways. Drug court is a big one, I think. No, it's using law enforcement. Law enforcement has an essential role in all this. And so, of course, supply interdiction is a big one. It's the best way of reducing harm is by reducing supply. But there is also this role, I think, that COVID showed us. COVID, what was COVID? One of the things that COVID was a year-long or more now, an unplanned experiment in what happens when you decriminalize drugs, when those drugs on the street are fentanyl and methamphetamine. You know, there's a lot of deaths, a lot of people going insane. And so that is real. I mean, that's misguided compassion. Well, we're not going to arrest them because, you know, this is the continuation of the drug war, and we're arresting them for paraphernalia, say, the possession of the syringes or what have you. Well, those syringes are red flags of much deeper problems, and that person needs to be off the street, because the other truth is this, particularly with fentanyl, there is no such thing as a long-term fentanyl user. They all die, okay? And so, and that is just the case. There is nobody who lasts. Heroin, you could last for 30, 40 years on heroin. I've known people to do that. That's not the case with fentanyl. So using the leverage that we are provided by arresting someone, getting them off the street, beginning detoxification, getting our drugs out of the system, and then beginning a system of recovery, that is the compassionate move, in my opinion. Just leaving them to kind of fester in what they're already festering in, you know, it sounds good. It sounds like, well, we're getting away from the drug war. The truth is, not with the drugs on the street today. They're too deadly. They're too mind-mangling.
You ended the book getting back to Portsmouth, which there's some interesting things going on there as well that give hope. And I thought one of the interesting angles on that, and again, we're getting into politics here, but this is an example of bipartisanship, if anything, was the fact that Obamacare provided more coverage for addiction treatment, the way I understand it. And states had the right to opt in or out. A lot of states opted out. John Kasich, the Republican governor, opted in against the opposition of some of his colleagues. And you talk about how that was a key to – that will be a key and is a key for any type of recovery at the local level.
It is, because a lot of folks have used up any possible insurance and, frankly, any goodwill that they may have. In order to actually get to an end of this, we need to find ways of covering drug treatment for a lot of folks, and Medicaid is one, and Medicaid expansion under Obamacare was certainly a big part of that. I would also say about Portsmouth, Ohio, that this is the kind of place that I found to be so fascinating, because I believe in Portsmouth, you're seeing kind of examples of what I'm talking about. You're seeing people coming together. This was a town where pretty much the sole story was, let's all get high and rip off the school district of its copper wire and the manhole covers and just create a lot of fatalism and destruction and all that kind of stuff. That was what Portsmouth lived through after its industrial decline through the 80s, 90s, and the 2000s. Now what you're seeing is another story being told in that town, and that's why I find it interesting. Not that the other story doesn't exist or hasn't existed. That would be a blindness to suggest that. But the idea is that all these folks now are finding each other. First of all, people who never were a part of that addiction problem are kind of finding each other, coming together. They're starting these small little companies. Nobody's expecting a big factory to come with 200 jobs and save the town. It's all like, you know, this idea, like, nobody's coming. We got to do this, you know, for ourselves. And so you find certain people coming together. A couple of them are veterans from Iraq or Afghanistan who helped villages over there come back you know, in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's a remarkable story, the couple of those guys in that town, Dale King and Tim Wolf in particular. And you're also seeing people understand that part of recovery of the town is getting in shape. So you're seeing people do CrossFit. You're seeing Sarito County, where the person was located, led Ohio really in obesity. Now you're seeing people say, we don't want to be fat all the time. We want to be known for that. We want to, you know, and CrossFit kind of also brings physical training and community together because you're doing it with other folks. And you begin to see this kind of, you know, recovery downtown. So all these beautiful brick buildings that they thankfully never tore down, that were been abandoned for years, now they're being renewed and renovated and turned into restaurants and apartments and all this. You are seeing the glimmers, okay, of little synapses, of little connections being put together by people who are now in the town, and that is growing. What's more fascinating of all, most fascinating of all, is that people now are coming down to Portsmouth to get sober. There's a lot of treatment in the area, a lot of drug treatment facilities, including a major one in town. And people are coming from all over Ohio to this town that once led the state into the opioid epidemic. Now people are coming, and they're finding that when people stay and they're sober, that they actually add a lot. You know, these are folks who, in another situation, could have probably did, you know, do a lot of damage to whatever town they were from. But they come, they get sober, and there's this, you know, kind of energy that comes with sobriety, a gratitude, an imagination, a creativity for life that didn't exist when you're on dope. To me, this is one of the great stories. It shows the kind of idea that I have that I'm trying to illustrate through this book, that through these small connections, bigger solutions can be eventually found. The thing is that if we're isolated, all problems seem insoluble. Once people begin to come together, it's a fascinating thing to watch. But once people come together, all these solutions begin to present themselves, and you can feed off each other's energy and positivity. And it's enormously important for business, for the Chamber of Commerce, that kind of thing. But it's also important as a way of getting away from dope and saying, no, we're all moving this way now. This is where, you know, you can go that way if you want. Anybody can do that, I guess. But we're moving this way now. And that's one of the beautiful, when I came back to Portsmouth, I was really struck by that. And that's why I put it kind of the very last chapter in the book, because it told the story that really motivated this book, which is not this deadly crud that's coming in and covering the country, but it's rather Americans behaving like Americans, coming together and working in small ways to make their community better. It's a beautiful thing, I think, what's going on there.
I agree, and we'll end it there on a happy note because this book has its share of topics and information that's depressing. But you do a good job, I think, of finding these areas that can give us hope springing up at the local level. So it's a great book, folks. The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth by Sam Quinones, who's been our guest today. He's a New York Times bestselling author of Dreamland. And it's an ongoing story, and I know you'll continue to follow it. And thank you again for taking the time to be my guest today.
Rob, it's great to talk with you. Say hello to your audience.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.